The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
This is Mike Consul. I want to welcome all of you to Author Spotlight. Our guest is Scott Swartz. He has been an investment advisor and financial analyst for more than 25 years. He has an undergrad degree in geography with an emphasis in weather and climate, which is worth mentioning because it's especially relevant to his book that we're going to be talking about, which is titled Investing in a New Climate. Also relevant is the fact that he's a member of the American Meteorological Society and is presently the founder and CEO of IntentVest. It's a Palo Alto-based sustainable investment advisory firm. His new book, whose full title is Investing in a New Climate, A Sustainable Approach to Investing and Living in a New Climate. A little bit of an echo there that I would have advised against, but that's okay. It's a done deal. It's in print. It's an ebook, maybe even an audio. In the book, he examines how potential social and economic disruptions will continue to have big impacts on local and global economies. That would, of course, include the United States at large, and how people can take advantage of investing in these areas affected by these changes. Maybe getting out of certain areas, jumping into certain areas. We'll find that out from Scott. Scott Swartz, welcome to the program.
Happy to be here, Mike.
You know, a book is a big undertaking, and but you have what I understand is kind of a unique perspective. You've been an airline pilot, a sailor, a world traveler, and you have made mention that it gives you a three-dimensional global perspective on what's going on out there. Elaborate on that for us.
Well, yes, Mike, I've done those things. I'm also an investment advisor, so I have an MBA and a background in finance, just so it's clear that it's not all about flying and sailing and exploring.
Yeah. Yeah. You're not out there in your client's money on a yacht in the Scottish islands or anything like that.
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say that, but to be honest, I've had an interesting perspective. I've been in the airline pilot business for several decades, but besides just flying, I've also managed the pension funds for the pilots. So I've spent a lot of time in the boardroom too. But mm-hmm. what inspired me to write this book was the adiabatic lapse rate. And what that is as you climb in altitude, there's about a 2 degree centigrade temperature loss. So it's 2 degrees cooler for every 1,000 feet you go up. So when we cruise at about 35,000 feet or so, we have a standard temperature, what the temperature should be. So about minus 45 degrees or something like that. And what we do is we plug into our computer what the difference is between the standard temperature and the actual temperature. And usually it was between 7 degrees colder, 7 degrees warmer, something like that. And then as time went on, it went from 7 degrees colder to 7 degrees warmer to almost always warmer. And then after about 10 years, it was much warmer. It was double digit warmer, often 10 degrees warmer at altitude and never colder than standard. So I noticed this big change at altitude, and it made me curious about the climate changing. From an empirical perspective, I noticed that it was really getting warmer at altitude. So that was my kind of first indication after about 10 years of flying. And then I started doing some sailing around the world. I was on an expedition from Europe to the US across the Atlantic. And I was in Greenland, and I ran into a group of scientists that said, hey, it's really the melting in the Greenland ice sheet is really profound. And I said, well, what do you mean profound? And he said, listen, I don't want to get into the politics of climate change, but it's accelerated in the last 10 years, more than millions of years prior to this, based on the ice, taking ice cores. Ice cores, you drill out these ice cores and it's like rings in a tree. And you can see how much melting there is each year. So he was really shocked by the amount of melting there had been. Also, I had done another trip a little later down to Antarctica, ran into another scientific group and pretty much had the same thing to say. I was in Antarctica and I noticed these huge ice sheets coming off in front of me, like apartment size pieces of ice chunks falling off in front of our boat. So it was pretty dramatic. And also back in Greenland, we got a notice to mariners saying there was an ice sheet half the size of Manhattan Island that came off. It was obviously a hazard to navigation. So there's a lot of empirical experiences I had as a pilot and as a sailor, realizing that climate change was the real deal.
Well, and we're seeing it today with wildfires and floods. And I know a lot of people say, well, we've always had them, but nothing like this. Rivers are drying up and so on. That's been going on for a while, but it just seems to be getting worse. So what are we looking at in terms of investment opportunities, given what you're seeing going on out there and not really knowing just how extreme it might become? What are some of the areas that you consult about with investors and say, we really need to stay away from maybe these categories, but these other asset classes would actually benefit by some of what's going on? Can you kind of suss that out for us a little bit?
Sure. And this book is not about doom and gloom. It's not about negativism. It's about opportunity. So the nine sectors that I've come up with to consider for investing are food and agriculture. The food industry is very large and it's evolving towards more local production, such as a farm-to-table movement, organic foods, and particularly plant-based foods. There's also genetic engineering, which is allowing meat to be grown in the lab at a cellular level, which on its face sounds disgusting, but it could be a good way to produce meat in the future. The second one is water. Water is a big deal. Obviously, anybody who saw the movie Chinatown knows how political it is. But in 2019, bottled water was the number one packaged beverage. Number three is transportation. It's a mechanism that allows economies and society to function. It's really the blood flow of our economy. And we're looking at fuel efficient vehicles. Obviously, electric cars is a big thing. The Teslas, right-sizing our fleet and re-rationalizing the supply chain frequency of transportation. So transportation is changing, and I think we all see it in terms of regulation mandating electric vehicles, that sort of thing. Number four is aviation and space. The FAA estimated the U.S. space industry has valued at approximately $158 billion in 2016. So the aerospace industry is looking for different fuels, lighter weights in the materials for aircraft, and then the space industry is burgeoning and becoming a much larger sector than it had in the past. Then we have the medical and technology sectors. Based on COVID and based on all of our recent experiences, the medical industry is $3.6 trillion in 2018. That's over $11,000 per person in medicine and medical devices. So technology has really become a big part of medical delivery system. Then there's renewable energy, which kind of tags into the transportation. Demand for renewable energy is expected to increase by about 81% by 2040. Energy demand, hydroelectric, solar, perhaps nuclear, wind and biomass should climb exponentially by 2040. Then there's real estate and construction, as we're seeing these superstorms and bigger weather impacts than we've ever seen before. The building materials, where we're going to invest in real estate, sea level rise, these are all factors in the real estate and construction sector. Then we get into computers and information technology. Quantum computing is something that's been around for a while, but now it's actually starting to work. We're starting to see a couple quantum computer companies. Basically, what they do is they take very large data, and they can do something with this data that never could be done before using qubits, basically a four times the amount of ones and zeros that creates a ability to analyze information in a way that's never been seen before. And then
such
finally,
as the unaligned weather changes. Coming weather changes and longer-term impacts of climate change, one would imagine. So and what was the final one there, Scott?
The final one is AI and robotics. AI is here to stay. Robotics is becoming a big thing. I think the problem with AI is not where to look to find AI. It's where it's not to look. I think AI is going to become a very pervasive technology in everything, particularly what you mentioned about weather detection. And we might be able to observe a tornado a few minutes before we could have in the past based on quantum computing and AI.
So a lot of these areas sound like disruptive technologies that are coming along, aside from climate change, that they're not really necessarily tied to climate change. It almost seems like you've tied it to kind of this new climate, this new reality. What about that? Because I could see that being a good portfolio in times of non-climate change if it never existed at all. I mean, water and food are critical, obviously, and always have been. And I recently saw, which is kind of a nightmare scenario, a story in the Wall Street Journal about crops wilting under the just brutal hellfire assault of the sun, hot weather. That would be a nightmare. Open farming, basically burning up from extreme temperatures. And I don't know if where you stand on that, Scott. But anyway, I'm kind of wandering around with this question. Go ahead and jump in wherever you see fit.
Well, the book is about climate with a big C. It's not just weather and climate. It's also disruptive technologies. So I've melded the impact of climate change and how to respond to that based on our portfolio, and also looking at new and exciting technologies that we can invest in as well. So it's not just the meteorological climate, but it's also the technological climate, as you pointed out. And just as an aside, today the Catholic Church just announced that climate change is one of their biggest priorities right now.
I wonder what they can do about it.
Well, it's just shocking.
It's going to take a lot of praying.
They admitted it, you know, because they were always fairly agnostic about the whole concept of climate change. But now when the Catholic Church is saying we need to worry about climate change, that's quite a message.
Yeah. Well, I grew up a Catholic, so no offense to anybody out there who's Catholic with my call for prayers or whatever. What about these nine sectors, though, in terms of, it would be very neat and clean to say, well, nine equal pieces, although you can't, nine doesn't give you necessarily equal pieces, but roughly equal pieces. But I suspect you would weight certain categories more than others. And this might be a climate change sleeve within a portfolio. Talk to that a little bit. What would you weight higher or lower? And would you be thinking of this as the totality of it would be the totality of a portfolio or a sleeve. And if it's a sleeve within a portfolio, how big a chunk would it be and so on?
Well, I think there's a couple ways to look at it. First of all, I would recommend in all investments that are somewhat ESG bent, what I recommend for clients is using ETFs that are tilted towards ESG. So it might be a large cap blend, it might be a mid cap or small cap or international, but all of them with a screening or filtering process that has some ESG component. That's where I start. And then secondly, when I move to these, I call them climate shares, where you're investing in specific type of investments that are not environment-based, but are more technology-based. And there are specific ETFs that address those sectors as well. As far as the weighting goes, that's kind of, I think, a bigger subject than this call today. But
there are a couple of categories there, though, that you think would need to have an especially big position because it's just there might be some categories there that just really warrant that.
I think food and water are at the top. My metaphor is people talk about using gold as a hedge in a down economy, and I much rather have food and water as my hedge, because what are you going to do with gold when things really get tough? But food and water are essential to life. And then I think I would move to medical technology and real estate, and then the others would be less, particularly aviation and computer technology and AI. But, you know, there wouldn't be anything wrong with equal weighting as well.
So what about food and water? Are you kind of betting on, and I know advisors don't like to use the word bet. This is my word, not yours. Are you betting on that there's going to be shortages? It's going to be a situation where it's going to drive up the value of food and water because we're going to have shortages.
Yeah, I do think that there's a couple things going on here. First of all, there could be shortages, and water, drinking water, is huge. That's going to be the biggest driver, I think, that a lot of countries, particularly Mexico, which is kind of funny, Mexicans don't drink their tap water anymore either because of the biologicals in it. So they're buying bottled water as well. So bottled water is probably going to be one of the largest commodities that are going to be, it's going to be sold out there more and more as time goes on. Only 5% of the water on Earth is fresh. The rest of it's salt water. And then as time goes on and there's more melting, there'll be even less fresh water. So then we're looking at desalination as a technology, which is an offshoot of water.
So that would be part of if you were investing in water, desal plants would be something that might be part of that investment picture.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then food, we're talking about hydroponics as an option. You talked about the sun negatively impacting crops. Well, one way to mitigate that would be to grow inside. And if you grow inside, use large hydroponic plants, then you have less influence by the atmosphere and by the use of water. Water usage would be much less in hydroponics, and also dry farming. So hydroponics, dry farming, bottled water are large components of the future economy, in my opinion.
I mean, I'm a big fan of indoor and vertical farming, urban farming, all that. But how much can we really grow indoors? I mean, if our outdoor crops, I mean, they've got to be 99% probably of what we eat. So I don't know how much is grown indoors, so I might have that figure wrong. But it doesn't seem even possible for us to, in a critical situation, to move our food production indoors with any kind of timetable that would save us from some severe shortages.
Well, you're right. I mean, there's a scale here, and I think there'll be places in the world where it will be economical to do more hydroponics and more indoor farming. There'll be places where it's not necessary to do that. Maybe Greenland will become an agricultural center. It actually once was thousands of years ago. So we might see a change of where crops are being grown, and we might see some elements of farming being done indoors. Over time, it will change. And as energy becomes cheaper and we can build these indoor areas like roses in Salinas are grown indoors now. So it's not going to happen overnight, but I think over time it will become more and more economical, and there'll be a phase of changing where things are grown and how things are grown, particularly dry farming, which is a way to grow almonds with much less water than just what they've been doing recently in the Valley.
So the problem, well, first of all, Congress has passed a bill. I think they're in the process of passing a bill, or has been passed. That's going to allow for money being allocated to Western states to start recycling water, the shower water, you know, basically water that's not potable, recycling that and using that as drinking water, recharging aquifers, hopefully. But, you know, in the United States, we have these massive coastlines. We could be doing desalination. There doesn't seem to be much talk about it or interest in it. I know that there's a couple big issues, which one is that reverse osmosis uses a ton of energy, but there's a lot of places where they could build their own renewable arrays, so that it's kind of like we're not going to be sucking off the grid. We've built our own solar and wind, geothermal, whatever it might be, and that's what we're using here. So we're 100% self-sufficient. And then there's the salt, which is just a matter of shipping it out to sea and not dumping it all at once in one spot, but to gradually unleash it so it doesn't disrupt the ecosystem, is my understanding. Do you know anything more about desalination and whether there's more going on there that I'm aware of?
No, I think there's a tipping point, Mike, and I don't think we've got there yet. When I've done some of my long distance sailing, we used reverse osmosis to get fresh water from the sea. And basically, you're just jamming salt water through these membranes and you get fresh water out of the other end. So we could do it by hand. We actually had a desalination device that we could pump. In an hour, we could get a gallon of water. So it's not high-tech technology at all. It just requires energy. And right now, we have enough fresh water that we don't need to do the reverse osmosis. But there will become a time, a tipping point, and it will depend on the area. Certain areas that are more stressed for water will find it more economically feasible to spend the money on the energy. And then as energy becomes more efficient with solar, and they could even use the waves to generate hydroelectric energy that could run the desalination devices. So we're very close, I think, to the tipping point where it will become economical to turn salt water into fresh water. But we're not there yet.
Now, you mentioned transportation and you hinted at the electrification. You're talking about electric cars, so kind of the electrification of our transportation systems, which seems to be well underway. What about that? What do you say about transportation in the book in terms of, and you've highlighted a little bit as one of your nine. What else can you tell us about that?
Well, my view is that eventually what we're going to probably end up doing is driving less. This COVID thing has been a real eye-opener about working from home. So I think one of the real benefits from this has been an experiment that we don't necessarily need to drive as much. The technology that I think is the most promising, this is going to sound silly, but the most promising technology is electric bicycles. If you could, they go 28 miles an hour and you can get reasonable places in a reasonable amount of time. And the technology is not as wasteful as electric cars that use a lot of energy and a lot of waste in the batteries and in the car itself. So I think the real future is going to be in driving less, using more mass transportation, and perhaps bicycles, electric bicycles versus
micromobility,
electric cars.
I think. That's a term I've heard, micromobility, with the bicycles, scooters, you know, those blades that got some, well, actually blades could be both just human powered or they sometimes come with a small engine on them. But yeah, I've seen those electric bikes and those are, I mean, you pedal, but when you need a boost or you want to go faster, it's just a matter of kicking that into gear. And I think you have to be doing some pedaling, but nonetheless, you're talking about something that can get you a place in a hurry. You said it gets up to 20 miles an hour, which is
28 miles an hour is the 28 max legal speed for about a motorcycle.
Oh, is that right? Okay. Yeah. That's pretty good velocity right there. So obviously those nine categories are what people will walk away from with your book. Are there some other overarching sorts of messages or impressions that you're looking to leave on the reader or that they should be walking away with, Scott? Are there some things you might identify beyond the nine that are, again, kind of overarching?
Yeah, there are a couple things. One is think about where you're going to live. It's also about living in a new climate. Maybe Southern Florida that's going to be underwater or the Gulf Coast. Or the Maldives may not be places you want to retire to. So give some thought to where you live and where you want to eventually live. And the other thing, this is the most overarching concept of this book. This is not about doom and gloom, but it's about adapting to change. We need to think about a new normal. It's not just about the climate. It's about, there's always climate change. Not having climate change is weird. So having climate change is normal. I'm not saying that this is part of a cycle. I'm not saying that at all. But we've adapted. I make a joke in the book in the beginning that Noah was an early adopter to climate change. And I think we need to think like that. We need to say, okay, we are living in a new climate. Things are going to change. Technology's changing. Are we going to put our head in the sand or are we going to adapt? And my vote is to adapt. Another metaphor I use in the book is as a pilot, we're looking at a thunderstorm in front of us. What do? Do we turn around? Do we fly through it or do we fly around it? And obviously, we fly around it, and that's a form of adaptation.
Yeah. So, adaptation. Do you have any? I realize you're probably not wanting to get into the politics of it, or the believability of it. But I'm just wondering, how's this going to play out? Do you have any any insights as to, or do you follow certain research that has indicated to you where we're going to land on this thing, like how extreme it might get, or are you not going there? Is that maybe just a wait and see approach and we make our adjustments as we go?
No, that's fine. The IPCC just came out with a new study a week or two ago saying things are much worse than what we thought. But on the other hand, they also said in the piece that we can make some profound impacts to mitigate the climate damage. But I'm a strong believer, if we can think about going to Mars and living on a planet like that, we certainly can fix this planet, or at least adapt to it. We can have stronger building materials. We could grow food differently. We could stop maybe having so much meat, and maybe because meat uses a lot of water. So perhaps we could have meat once a week instead of five times a week. So I'm a big believer that we can mitigate climate change a bit, and certainly we can adapt to it. I think we have the technology and the will. Humankind has been adapting since the beginning of time, and I have no reason to believe we won't continue to. So I really want to be positive about this. The cup is half full, and I think we need to make these investment changes. One of the strongest points of the investment world is affecting the chief financial officer. Most companies have created an ESG department. Recently, I heard a story from an ESG manager that he got called in to do a rug dance in front of the CFO. And the CFO, who was not really a big climate guy, said, "Darn it, we need to step up our game with ESG. I'm having trouble getting new investment. And the best way to get new investment these days is to enhance our ESG footprint, to look at least create an impression and the reality that we're doing something positive towards the environment." So by investing in ESG, we're putting pressure on companies to do the right thing. 1/3 of every institutional dollar is in the ESG sector right now. And that's in the US. In non-US, it's even more. There's a law in France that says if given the two options to recommend to a client an ESG company or a non-ESG company, you're legally obligated to pick the ESG company. So wow. That type of movement, everything we're doing here, in things we're talking about the book in terms of adaptation and the type of investment we're talking about, will create mitigation. So as long as we wake up and we do these things, I think the futures will be different, but we will continue.
Our guest has been Scott Swartz. He is an investment advisor and financial analyst. He's been doing that for more than 25 years. You heard a little bit about his background at the top, and we've been talking about his new book, which is titled Investing in a New Climate, A Sustainable Approach to Investing and Living in a New Climate. And it's available, you know where it's available. It's available anywhere books are sold these days. That's not any trouble getting your hands on books once you have the title or the author's name. Scott, congratulations on the book. Thank you for taking the time and giving us some insights.
Thanks, Mike. It's a pleasure talking to you.